This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. The title of this tape is Evolution. The title and the subject of this tape was inspired by a casual but nonetheless perceptive remark made by Professor William Mara of Fordham University. While commenting upon the part of the unfortunate condition of the contemporary church and its educational structure, he stated that he judged two things to be the causes in their general deterioration. These were the belief in evolution and the use and belief of psychology. As I had once before been asked to produce a work on the subject of evolution, I decided that his remarks were a providential sign and an inducement to produce this tape. As is appropriate and habitual in these tapes, allow me to define the term under question. And, in order to achieve better clarity, I shall deal with each subject separately. In this tape, I shall deal with the so-called theory of evolution. Evolution is the belief that one animal can, over time, become a totally different animal by some kind of natural process. In other words, it means that animals can and do come from animals which are unlike them in any way. To the biologist, the presence of frogs in a swamp means that other frogs must have been there before, or other frogs must have come from somewhere else. The biologist holds that frogs come from frogs, and from other frogs, and so forth, all the way back to Noah or the Garden of Eden. The believer in evolution holds that the presence of frogs means that something other than frogs probably was around and that the frogs developed from this something else. He also holds that probably frogs will ultimately become something else. I shall deal with some of these problems with considering evolution as a science later. But now, let me simply say that science does not deal with probabilities, but deals with facts, laws, and measurements. Scientific principles allow a man who has knowledge of them to make perfectly valid predictions as to what will happen when certain conditions are met. Science deals with cause and effect. I can predict with perfect validity that fire will give off heat and light. And I can predict with perfect validity how to cause a fire to occur. The evolutionist does none of these. He does not explain what causes these so-called changes to occur, nor does he make any kind of prediction as to what will occur in the future. These are major and insolvable problems for the evolutionist, but more on this later. Right now, let me make the matter as clear as possible. Evolution holds that frogs, left alone long enough, will probably fly. This is because they hold that birds are really flying dinosaurs, that is to say, lizards with feathers. By this, I do not mean that the frogs will become flying frogs, but rather they will become eagles. Evolution holds that fish can and do become dogs, that monkeys can, given enough time, write novels which win Nobel Prizes for literature. Regardless of how else the evolutionist tries to hide its true position, this is what it really holds. Before I go any further, allow me to deal with the nature of animals. To make and keep things very simple, let me give a working definition of what a particular kind of animal is. A distinctive animal is that creature which can reproduce, if reproduction is normal for it, when mated with another animal of its own kind. This is a purely relative definition, but unless we wish to become bogged down in biological distinctions which are not of concern to us, it will have to suffice. In other words, a dog can mate with another dog and produce a puppy. Dogs have huge variations in appearance, size, behavior, etc. But all dogs can reproduce other dogs. There are animals which look like dogs, some which behave like dogs, etc. But unless they give birth or are father to puppies, they are not dogs. The same applies to birds such as crows, to fish such as sharks, etc. This does not mean that new breeds of horses, fish, birds, and dogs, etc., cannot be created, so to speak. They certainly can. But they are still birds, fish, mammals, etc. There are also freaks in nature, such as albinos and dwarfs. But freaks are not new animal types, but rather unusual examples of previously existing types. The evolutionist holds that new animals are somehow produced from old animals. In order to demonstrate how stupid this view is, allow me to point out to you what evolutionary theory is not. By the way, I hope that you are beginning to see how stupid this so-called theory actually is. There is a term which is frequently used in conjunction with evolution. It is called natural selection. Natural selection is a term used to describe and explain changes in animal types. It is not, I repeat, it is not evolution, because it does not describe or explain one animal type or kind becoming another animal type or kind. It simply describes one animal type changing. I shall illustrate. If a turtle has a longer neck than its fellow turtles, if it is a freak, then it can reach higher with his mouth than others. This means he can eat plants which are higher off the ground than the other turtles can. If food becomes scarce, as during a drought, this turtle is likely to survive, or is more likely to survive than others, as he has more potentiality as far as food goes. This means that if most of the other short-necked turtles die off during the time of shortage, then this turtle, the long-necked type, is more likely to mate than the other short-necked turtles. He would even have more time, as he would spend less time looking for plants closer to the ground, as he has a wider variety. If he passes on this characteristic to his children, the characteristic being the longer neck, then his children will also have a better chance of mating and survival. If bad times come every now and then each time the long-necked turtles will survive and mate at a higher rate than the normal turtles. And eventually, only the long-necked turtles will exist. The same could explain why horses run faster today than thousands of years ago. The slower ones got eaten. But we know that the runners of the 1980 in the Olympics run faster and farther than the fastest runners of the 1950 Olympics. They jump higher, too. This does not mean that the men of the 1950s were not men, and the men of 1980s are, nor vice versa. And this is the key part, this does not mean that the turtle with the long neck is a new animal. He is the same type as before, except he has a longer neck. If one could transport one turtle through time and introduce him to a descendant or an ancestor, they could still mate and produce baby turtles. Natural selection is no more than a certain advantage which one animal obtains, which gives it an advantage over its fellows. If and when the times are tough, the naturally selected animal, that is the one with the naturally selected advantage, will last while the average unimproved model, so to speak, will die off. Natural selection is a perfectly reasonable explanation of certain observed phenomena in nature. But it does not say that turtles grow wings and fly. Flying turtles with feathers are simply not turtles. A turtle does not have feathers. A turtle growing feathers is not natural selection. It is simply a turtle becoming another animal. Although certainly God could do this, there is no reason to believe that he has ever done so. I deal with this more later on. But even if such a divine event did occur, it would be an act of creation and not an act of evolution. Evolution is one animal becoming some other animal by some process other than God. Creation is something beginning because God causes it to happen. The fact that God may use something which already exists does not change the fact that it is still creation. God created man out of clay or dust, but it was still creation and not man evolving from clay or dust. Let me turn to the next thing which evolution is not. Evolution is not science. It is not in the scientific field of study. It is not a scientific discipline. So that you will understand this better, let me give a brief definition of science. Science is that field of study and field of knowledge in which man learns of the mathematical relationships of natural phenomena. Science is always a relationship between cause and effect. Science has some extremely strict standards. For something to be scientific fact or scientific study, it must be measurable in numbers, it must be repeatable, it must be verifiable by observation, and it must be independent of who observes the event occurring. That is to say, it must be objective. Scientific experiments can be done by anyone, and the exact same results will occur. The same procedure X will yield the same result Y for anyone in the field of science. This result can be measured in terms of numbers, and this knowledge may be conveyed to anyone and repeated by anyone under the same circumstance. If a scientific theory is offered, it can be tested if the technology exists to conduct the test. If the technology is not existent, then it remains merely a theory. But even so, it must express a relationship between cause and effect. An example of a scientific fact: heat plus oxygen plus combustible materials cause fire. This can be tested and proven. When dealing with evolution, the following questions are asked. What causes it? If God, then it is not evolution, but rather creation. If something else, the question becomes, what is the something else? Unless this something else is specified, then not even a theory is being offered. Scientific theory offers a potential relationship between cause and effect. Evolution says a pig can become a bat, or vice versa, a bat can become a pig. Why? The evolutionist says, who knows? I repeat, that natural selection cannot be offered as a cause of evolution. Natural selection explains how variations within an animal type benefit the newer models. So understand that evolution can be offered as something, but it is not by any means whatsoever in the field of science. Another point. Evolution is not consistent. Evolution is a house divided against itself. Before I specify how, allow me to explain the problem with this. The law of identity, first formulated by Aristotle and very familiar to all ARM patrons, holds that something can be true or false, but not both true and false under the same circumstances. I give a simple example. X can be an odd number or an even number, but it cannot be both odd and even at once. You need not know what X is to know that, assuming normal mathematical relationships, that it must be odd or even, one or the other. If someone offered a theory which required that the same number be both odd and even at the same time, and that it be less and greater than 2 at the same time, then you need not know any more to know that this theory cannot be true. If a race requires the runner to be first and last at the same time, then this condition is not meeting the requirements for a race. Evolution states the following. Changes require long times to occur. If you were to ask an evolutionist why you have never seen a frog become a chicken, nor a pig learn how to use a typewriter, the evolutionist will tell you that some changes require millions and millions of years to happen. A slight footnote here. The simplest question to ask, of course, is why? If a frog can become a chicken, or a crow an alligator, why should it take millions of years? What is the principle involved here? If human beings can go from being about as useful as a frog, which is about how useful we are at birth, to becoming great scientists in a mere few decades, why can't frogs go from jumping around in the mud to driving automobiles in the same period of time? The evolutionist has no answer. The principle, so-called, involved in this is the following. What occurs over millions of years cannot be reflected in what happens in a brief period of time. What do we mean by brief periods of time? We will ask the evolutionist. Well, he will answer, frogs do not start sprouting feathers in a day, nor a summer, nor a year. In fact, no man has ever recorded that while he lived, he saw a frog become a pigeon. And men have been watching frogs for lifetimes, and they've been watching pigeons for as long. So this brief period of time must be more than a lifetime. But we do have recorded historical records of men observing things, such as frogs and pigeons, which go back approximately 6,000 years. In all that time, no one has ever recorded that lions have learned how to barbecue their food, and dogs have learned how to hunt from horseback. And they have written records which include references to lions and dogs for 6,000 years. And those lions and dogs behave the same way they do now. So the evolutionist is required to say that this length, namely 6,000 years, is a brief period of time. And their so-called principle becomes this. What happens in anything under 6,000 years cannot be used to show what will happen in millions and millions of years. Keep this in mind, because I will refer to it later. The evolutionist uses fossils to try to show evolution. Fossils are the remains of something which lived and is now dead. In other words, remains of something dead. An evolutionist finds a bone and states that it is a million years old or 100 million years old. Evolutionists are like lawyers. When suing for large amounts, lawyers tend to say, let's throw in a few more zeros. What difference does it make? Evolutionists have the same mentality. Let's throw in another three zeros. What's the difference between a million and a billion? Unfortunately, politicians seem to have this attitude also. But let's return to the bone. The evolutionist finds the bone, and he says this million-year-old bone is that many years old because it has the characteristic X and not characteristic Y, which shows that the pig, the human, the frog, or the lizard was evolving into something else. And because this took place over millions of years of evolutionary process. Now, I hope none of this made any sense to you, because it doesn't make any sense. Simply because you find a characteristic in a bone doesn't mean of any sign of evolution. But forget for a moment that none of this makes any sense. Instead, concentrate on the topic of time, which, of course, is essential to the evolutionist argument. This bone is millions of years old. Says who? After all, it is not dated with a serial number, nor does it have some kind of certificate of authenticity. How do they decide how old something is? The method which is commonly used is called the carbon-14 method. This means that object X contains so much carbon-14. Carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope of carbon. This means that it decays at a certain set rate. So if bone X had amount A of carbon-14 in it when its owner died, then by figuring out how much is in it now, one can figure out how long it took the carbon-14 in it to reduce itself to its current measurable level. Let me put this slightly differently. It's a key point. If carbon-14 reduced itself by half every 10 years, These are arbitrary numbers. Then if you had 2 pounds of it in 1990, you would have only 1 pound of it in the year 2000. By the same token, you would have had 4 pounds of it in the year 1980. Seems very simple, doesn't it? But there are a few problems. First, the entire concept of radioactive decay is based on the following assumption. That assumption is this. What has been observed and measured in recent years is what has always happened, as back in millions and millions of years ago. The whole concept of radioactivity started in the late 19th century. But accurate measurements of things such as carbon-14 are much, much newer. These techniques are a few decades old. To use them, the so-called scientist must make the assumption that what has happened in the last few decades, when carbon-14 could be measured under truly scientific, that is to say, laboratory conditions, correctly reflects what happened in the past. But hold on a minute. Before we learn that, for evolution to maintain itself, it must argue that what happened over long periods of time cannot be reflected by what happens in a short period of time. Now, in order to sustain itself, it must argue that what happened in recent years is precisely what happened in the last several million or billion or zillion years ago. Again, in order for evolution to take place over a long period of time, the evolutionist must put his faith in carbon-14 dating of old fossil records. But this, of course, says that we can extend the short into the long, but we cannot compress the long into the short. This is a violation of the laws of identity. A related problem is this. How does anybody know how much carbon-14 was in the bone when its owner died? Well, the so-called scientist will conclude that if today's rabbit has, say, 4% carbon-14, then the rabbit of a few zillion, billion, trillion years ago had the same amount of carbon-14. What is the principle behind this assumption or conclusion? It is the principle that in nature, things do not change. Well, this is an assumption which could be argued. But if things do not change, then evolution, which is only another word for change, does not take place in nature. But if evolution, namely change, does take place, then we cannot put reliance in the assumption that rabbits ate the same amount of food containing carbon-14 in the same amounts then as now. And how can they even assume that it was the same amount of carbon-14 was around then? Was anybody around to measure it? Again, a completely self-contradictory set of assumptions, both of which are necessary for evolution to be sustained. Notice the conclusions. If evolution is to be accepted, then what happens in brief time periods must reflect what happens over long time periods. And what happens in brief time periods must not ever reflect what happens in long time periods. But the law of identity requires that one of these situations, and not both, be true. But the evolutionist demands that both be true and false at the same time. Notice also that evolution requires that change be utterly a part of the normal course of nature, but at the same time requires that nothing change, not even the diet of rabbits when they were running around several billion years ago trying not to be eaten by dinosaurs. Either things change or they don't change, but evolution requires that things change and that they never change at the same time and in the same circumstances. Again, a violation of the law of identity. Note that if either of these contradictions is resolved, with the truth being on one side or the other, either things change or they don't, small things reflect long things, then evolution cannot stand. If either of these choices in either case is true, and one must be true and the other must be false, then evolutionary fails. Or to put it slightly differently, evolution is self-contradictory. Another aspect of this subject that you should realize is that many times the word evolution is used to substitute for development. If one looks at all the very different types of breeds of dogs, one realizes that these animals can develop in different ways and yet still be dogs. Some dogs are quite at home in the Arctic, while others thrive in the jungle. Again, the point here is that these animals are still dogs and not fish. Some people argue that whales and dolphins were, a long time ago, actually land creatures. This theory holds that they evolved into sea creatures. If this is true, and quite frankly, who really knows, then what happened was not evolution, but adaptation and development. The whale may have walked into the sea and never come back and still be a whale. Raccoons never used to open metal garbage cans before Columbus discovered America. But now one could almost define a raccoon, at least in my area of New York, as a big squirrel which knows how to open garbage cans to get into the inside. Back in pre-Columbian days, seagulls did not hang around shopping malls eating garbage. But this is about all they do, again, at least in my part of New York. They are still seagulls, they are still raccoons, but they live quite differently from their ancestors. There is no evolution here, any more than people are a different type of creature because we now fly in machines. It is simply a matter of adaptation and change. Again, the discussion is evolution. It is important to distinguish between development and real changes. Can a Catholic believe in evolution? In a certain sense, yes, but in another sense, no. Allow me to elaborate. There is a certain Christian evolution thesis. This holds that God himself causes creatures to develop to the point that they change into new creatures. This means that God creates by using the evolutionary process to bring about new creatures. One could even hold that the first man was created from some pre-human but human-like creature. This creature became man when God breathed the immortal soul into this creature, making him man. Now, something like this could be reconciled with Catholic dogma, as it does allow the specific creation of God, correction of man by God. There are problems with this, however. Evolution is a scientific question similar to the issue of abortion, which is a medical scientific question. Yes, the church teaches that the child is alive from conception onwards, but this is a scientific as well as a theological fact. The Catholic is always obligated to accept all truth wherever he finds it. Evolutionary is, as has been shown above, a failure when measured purely from a scientific criterion. But if one removes it out of the field of science, where it fails miserably, and into the field of something else, some sort of a faith situation, could one believe it? Again, there are problems. The first is that there is a general rule in philosophy which holds that the simplest means should be used to achieve an end. This is Occam's razor. This means that one should not necessarily expand the number of factors involved in a problem. In other words, unless there is evidence to the contrary, one should take the simplest solution. I freely admit that this is not an absolute rule, but I point out that there is no reason to prefer the complex method of evolutionary creation as opposed to the simple traditional view. Another problem is that this pre-human creature existed, then this creature is reconstructed as a short, ugly, hairy, crude, human animal-like creature. In other words, not at all like the perfect man that Adam was. In other words, God would be taking a creature which is truly a ugly animal and then recreating him to be tall, beautiful, graceful, intelligent. Animal was not crippled as we are by original sin. The difference between animal and this creature is similar to the difference between a beautiful woman and a sea slug. As we humans today are more like other creatures than we are these proto-humans, the conclusion would be that the creation actually raised up these proto-humans to a higher level than we are would be more difficult to believe than original sin lowered us from some level that was far more beautiful. Again, this is not to say that this view is impossible. I simply point out that it is not reasonable, nor is it probable. Simply to believe something without cause is called credulity, and is an occasion of sin if not a vice. It can lead to one accepting lies as truth. The view of evolutionary creation can, with a great deal of effort and complexity, be made to reconcile with the simple creation story of Genesis. But a general rule of understanding Scripture is to take the literal meaning as meaning exactly what it says, unless it goes against another part of Scripture or against church truth, or against some other truth. In other words, literal stories should be taken literally, unless there is good reason to do otherwise. Evolution could be a good reason if it had any basis other than simple belief. As it has none, it is my opinion that no good, prudent, reasonable Catholic can adhere to it. You may obtain additional copies of this tape or any of our other tapes by contacting us at ARM55 Palen, Palen Road, number 38, Hopewell, Junction, New York, 12533. Thank you for listening. God bless.